There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast on the left.
Live from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Guys.
Yes, sir.
I'm rebranding.
You are. Yeah. Are we all now, rebranding or just you?
Just me, bro. Okay. Just me. Okay, because I'm too dangerous to just be a comedian.
Wow.
Yeah.
You want to be a cop also?
There's too much. Daddy! Daddy, why, Daddy? No. My song's too dark. My lyrics are too disastrous to the fucking capitalism complex.
Wow. Yeah. Deep stuff.
I'm a bard more than anything. I'm a truth teller. I'm a truth speller.
Are you someone who can get on with it?
That's not a part of my new brand. But I'm thinking the name is Night Horse. Right? Because you can't see him at night. All of a sudden he shows up. Oh, how lucky you got a horse here. He'll take you anywhere you want to go. But also, never mind. You better hope that horse doesn't talk because he might say some things that might push your boundaries.
Very cool. Well, it's great to have you with us, Night Horse. Welcome to the last podcast on the left. That's your catchphrase?
Yep.
What is it again?
Nay. Night Horse.
Ooh, wow. Enigmatic.
Wow. Oh, that's what it's all about, man. I am too mysterious to be a comedian anymore.
Wow. This is high quality content here on the last podcast on the left. I am Ben, hanging out with Henry and, of course, Marcus Parks.
Hello.
This will be a very exciting episode. Is this a gold star episode?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Night Horse says, yay.
I'm upset. All right, everyone. Let's talk Danny Rowling, part two.
So when last we left Daniel Rowling, he just recorded a long-winded goodbye message to his family in a Sarasota motel room, apologizing for his upcoming horrific acts that he now felt were either necessary, inevitable, or both.
And I'm just gonna need you to know that pre-apology is as good as me not doing the crime.
Okay.
Now, the horrible acts in question would be committed in Gainesville, home of the University of Florida. But before Danny popped up there, he first swung by another college town in Florida. According to an inmate confidant who shared a cell with Danny after the Gainesville murders, Danny Rowling first went to Tallahassee out of a fascination for Ted Bundy, owing to the fact that it was in Tallahassee that Bundy embarked on his final berserker spree.
Wait, he fanboyed over Ted Bundy to the point he took a pilgrimage like it was freaking Elvis?
This actually speaks to, and I mean, technically, we've all done this type of fanboy. As true crime, like, people?
No,
we've
but
all
done
these types of things.
Yeah, but you don't go and tour the grave of Ed Gein and then start digging up bones all around it and be like, I'm just like him.
Marcus?
No. After me and Carolina took our Jim Jones tour of Indiana, I didn't start a cult.
He didn't poison anyone?
No, he just helped. He did.
There's a massive difference.
Marcus was very adamant about more merch, though.
Yes, that's true. Of course.
See, Danny Rowling had actually planned to commit his murder spree in Tallahassee and had even gone as far as to buy a new K-bar knife in town for the occasion. But for reasons that remain vague, Danny instead chose Gainesville.
Well, Danny said, first of all, as soon as a K-bar is blooded and as soon as it knows human blood, it can only thirst for more human blood.
I mean, it really can. It's a knife.
But this story, I mean, in the Pixar world.
Yes.
But according to the book, The Making of a Serial Killer, I got this. It arrived at my house. This is one of those rare, out of print, old school, I want to say, dripping with blood type book, because it is written by Danny Rowling and his lover and ex-fiance, now that he's in hell, Sandra London.
Sandra London.
And if you read this book, the first thing that really hit me was, number one, that it is the literal same exact structure as our book.
Oh,
because it is Sandra talking, then Danny talking, and then, guess who makes a surprise appearance?
Dom DeLuise.
Gemini.
His
other personality. If you don't remember, Gemini or Enod, which is Danny backwards.
Oh, my God.
That is the entity that did these crimes. And Gemini / Enod, he chose Gainesville.
Okay.
And I will explain. This book is... is interesting because I think it pulls back the curtain a little bit on the fact that Danny Rowling, unlike Pee-wee Gaskins, right? Pee-wee Gaskins, that's final truth. That book made the crimes of Pee-wee Gaskins even worse, right? Yeah. Because Pee-wee Gaskins is a tiny guy who was looking to be a made man in prison. He wanted to be a big deal. He wanted to appear to be very, very scary to people because he was a little guy with an inferiority complex.
Sure.
Danny Rowling is the opposite. Danny Rowling, I think, and then we'll talk about this as we go, actually belittled his crimes.
Yeah.
To himself so that he would not fully acknowledge that he was such a depraved animal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he didn't want to, because he's the apology killer. But now let's talk about, this is why Gemini chose Gainesville.
Yeah, why Gainesville?
Why Gainesville? That's the top of the chapter, chapter 8, possessed by the Reaper. Believe me, I've asked myself that question many times. Danny nor Enod meant any harm to Gainesville, except robbery. I've been driven by the winds that rise when the sun sets and the night calls. Night horse. The spirits take wing and pop to their lovers, who have an ear to hear their whisperings, and so they call to me, come out, Danny. Come dance with me. The night spirits would take my hand, and I would follow where the crickets ring, hypnotic tones, and the wind plays through the dry leaves of the grandfather oaks. Through the hollow night, would you catch your breathful fright? I saw Gemini's wicked reflection smiling back at me in the mirror, and he said one word, blood. And from that point on, Gemini became the domineering force in my mind, and Danny was out of control, big time.
I think I would rather hang out with Scott Stapp from Creed. That is such a colossal pain in the ass way to say I wanted to go to fucking Gainesville.
No, you don't understand.
I don't know.
Somebody like the Night Horse. I don't know what happens to me when Night Horse comes. When Night Horse comes, I do all sorts of crazy shit. I postmated seltzer to my house last night.
Wow.
That's Night Horse.
That's not you. I agree with that. That's a Night Horse move.
And so by late August of 1990, Danny traveled to Gainesville and found a Walmart where he bought a tent but stole a screwdriver, a roll of duct tape, and two pairs of athletic gloves.
Oh my God, you present it as if it's the Donner Party where he found a magical Walmart, as if they're not fucking everywhere intruding our safe space.
This is when it was more fun to go to Walmart.
Oh, it still is.
But also he was smart because he knows you steal the implements of murder.
Yeah.
Oh.
Then Danny built a campsite in a wooded park near the University of Florida and began stalking his victims. When Danny wasn't stalking, though, he was recording even more messages into his tape recorder, all of which seemed oddly disconnected from what Danny Rowling was about to do, apart from this one message to his brother. He said, quote,
Kevin, you better get a daggum deer for me with that bow I got you now. Aim for the lungs. Straight through the rib cage, either there or the heart. The best thing to do is hit the lungs. It's the best shot for a deer, straight through the lungs. He don't go far.
Oh man, I thought he was gonna start every recording with note to self. Remember that when Norm MacDonald used to do that, but then he would tell a joke, but then this guy just talked about how he wanted to murder people.
This book has the full transcript of the tapes, and it does sort of start being like,
yeah, well, just sitting on a bunch of leaves. Feeling kind of cold. Aww. It's hard to write guitar songs when you're cold, but that's when I call upon my other brother, Night Horse.
He wow. comes.
Now, when it comes to how and why Danny committed these murders, it's obvious to me that they were the perfect example of a pathetic serial killer taking out his frustrations on people who had nothing to do with why his life was an awful fucking mess. See, Danny later told a fellow inmate that he considered being stabbed to death to be the worst way to die. And that's exactly how he killed each and every one of his victims. He took his own frustrations and his own fears, and he fucking threw it out into the world.
Well, according to him, in some of these scenes in this book are, I mean, obviously very difficult to get through because he does recount in a lot of detail what he did in the rooms with his victims. And he does it in a very salacious way, but also at the same time, constantly being like, Gemini was the one who jumped in my hands and he was the one who chose these implements. And I kept yelling, Gemini, no, Gemini, let's go to Whataburger.
Right.
Gemini, no. And like, it's as you watch him do this type of thing, he he knew all along what he was doing. And he set up these little notes to self to basically say, like, look, there was I never meant none harm, none what. Because you put it through the lungs, and the deer just goes to sleep and wakes up in heaven.
Gemini didn't listen.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to thank the people over at Whataburger HQ who sent me some fun Whataburger merch.
Really?
Oh, very nice.
It was a good get.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, in addition to the method of murder, the victim who went through the most fear, torture, and mutilation of all of Rowling's victims during the spree, Krista Hoyt, looked almost exactly like Omatha Halco, Danny's ex-wife. But perhaps most telling is that despite future claims of demons and entities, Danny originally used the revenge on the world excuse for why he committed the murders, saying that he had to kill one person for every year he'd served in prison for the armed robberies he himself had committed.
And I took that personally. Michael Jordan won 6 rings with the same mentality. It's the Mamba mentality. He focused the energy in the wrong direction.
And that's why I, Nighthorse, will spend I will eat a tres leches cake for every year I didn't go to an improv school.
Marcus, not to derail totally, have you had tres leches cake yet?
I have not.
Oh,
milk.
That stuff's a bit rich for me.
It is the greatest thing ever.
Now, Danny had served 8 years total in prison, so while the triple murder of the Grissom family in November of 1989 got the ball rolling, Danny still had 5 to go, and he'd take those 5 right there in Gainesville. Now, Danny Rowling intended to begin his killing spree on August 23rd, and even went as far as to climb up to the second floor balcony of an apartment, where he stripped off all of his clothes except for a fanny pack containing duct tape and his K-bar knife.
Oh my God, Wendy, look, it's Ham Man. Isn't that nice?
I protect the whole world from salt by absorbing it myself.
Wow, Ham Man. He's here again to save the day.
Hold on to my varicose veins. I'll save you, young girl.
But it was a lucky thing for whoever happened to live there that a drunken University of Florida student happened to wander by and point out that there was a naked man wearing a fanny pack on the balcony, and Danny was forced to abort.
It's a naked guy. I always remember the one time I used to do a sketch for Murderfist called Boardroom.
Oh, of course. All nude review.
I remember one
that's
time.
That's how I know exactly what your tiny ass looks like.
Of course. You can probably draw it from memory. It's Calvin's butt. I have the same butt as him. But I remember one time I do that sketch. I come out completely nude, holding my balls in the middle of the sketch. And I remember coming out, and all I heard was one woman scream from the back, "He naked!" That was in South Carolina, and I always remember that.
That's the reaction you want.
But the next night, on August 24th, 1990, Danny Rowling began the murders that would earn him the Gainesville Ripper moniker. And I'm going to go ahead and say that there are at least 2, if not 3, gold stars in this episode. So strap the fuck in and get ready.
Yeah, man, okay. This ain't going to be rough, and we don't have Glenn Borland to hide from it. We don't have him to hide behind. Maybe this is a good time to take a bolt of whiskey.
Like, if you're at work, this is not a joint, then. No joints for this one.
No joint.
Oh.
No joint. This is a fucking neat glass of the hardest whiskey you have, and then you just sit in it, and then you can really feel like a private investigator. You look out, like, wherever you go to the highest point of your home, wherever you live, and look out upon the city and think about, what am I going to do to save this pile of bricks?
Right. How are we going to stop Ham Man?
Yeah, this is a detective's pour of an episode.
Okay, great.
Now, for the Gainesville Ripper murders, Danny Rowling dropped the Rambo outfit that he'd used for the murder of the Grissom family and instead opted for a black ski mask, athletic gloves, and an actual ninja's outfit.
Night Horse.
So, dressed as a ninja at 3 a.m., Danny Rowling approached the apartment of Sonia Larson and Christina Powell, both of whom Danny had been stalking for days. Using a screwdriver, Danny pried open the bottom of the apartment's wooden door and found Christina Powell asleep on the couch. Danny stood watching her sleep for 10 minutes, then went upstairs where he watched Sonia Larson sleep for an additional 5. Finally, he made the decision to kill Sonia first so he could take his time with Christina.
Thankfully, I'm the type of person that if I hear someone go like while I'm sleeping, I wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, after making the decision, Danny plunged the knife into Sonia's collarbone while she was still asleep and almost immediately taped her mouth shut when she woke up confused and in pain. Then he began stabbing towards her chest, slicing open her arms and hands as she tried to defend herself. Mm. But within a minute, Sonia Larson was dead from blood loss. Danny Rowling then walked back downstairs to where Christina Powell was still sleeping and woke her by taping her mouth shut. He then overpowered her, taped her hands behind her back, and repeatedly raped her. Danny then turned her over on her stomach and stabbed her in the back as deep as the knife would go, over and over again. And after Christina expired, Danny cut off her breasts and wrapped them in plastic. Finally, Danny cleaned whatever sexual evidence he left behind using a bottle of dish soap and posed the bodies to cause the maximum amount of shock for whoever discovered the grisly double murder scene. With Christina, he posed her on the living room floor in a lewd position, face up so it would immediately be seen that her breasts had been removed. Mm. And with Sonia, he posed her on her bed, lying on her back with her legs bent at the knees so that her feet hung down to the floor. Danny then took a nap in Christina's bed, showered, and left when the sun came up, singing a hymn to himself on his way back to the campsite. Later, the only noises neighbors would report that night was loud banging, which would have been unusual if not for the fact that Danny Rowling chose to listen to the George Michael song Faith loudly and repeatedly throughout the entire brutal affair.
And the pain of that moment came through in Fred Durst when he covered Faith.
Yeah, that was a bad cover. That is, dude, that is one of the most horrific things I think that we have ever covered as far as a double murder goes.
It's just weird to have somebody who, this is kind of why Danny Rowling is interesting to me, because he combines a lot of types of serial killers in one for some reason, because you think that he's like a Henry Lee Lucas moron killer, right? Like there's that one side where he's a moron killer who is completely impulsive, a lot of brain damage, can't control himself, and he just goes into fits and rages and kills and then goes like, what did I do? Like, there is that. There is the fact that I believe that he was a serial killer fanboy, so that he read up on Ted Bundy. This is a very Ted Bundy style murder then. Yeah. At the same time, it shows someone has done a lot of planning. It shows that he has done a lot of pre-production,
He went to the ninja store to buy the ninja outfit.
He did all of this shit, and he knew that he wanted to do it. He had a plan in mind. But then the manipulation of the body is like another killer again, where it's somebody else, where then he takes possession. He goes from, he obviously is some form of process killer, but then he goes straight into then product killer behavior, where he is spending time with the body, doing those things that to me speaks, he is a much more dangerous person than you'd think he is, right? Well, when you meet him.
And absolutely. I have to say, you know, you mentioned he was listening to George Michael's Faith. Evidently, he never saw the video because George Michael was wearing a t-shirt that said, choose life. And that video is fantastic. And
I guess actually, Ben, I got to correct here. You're thinking of Wham and you're thinking of Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
Holy shit. The premise of the joke stands. George Michael did wear a shirt that said choose life and he is a fan. So it is adjacent, but thank you for the correction.
I also would like to commend all of us on not choosing the easy rolling Limp Bizkit joke and instead going for a Limp Bizkit Faith joke.
Wow. Professionals, buddy. Yeah. Professional.
We've grown.
Well, I think speaking to what you were talking about, I think really you hit it in the beginning with the impulse control. And I think a lack of impulse control is what defines Danny Rowling. And that's why he is both a product and a process killer, because everything is done on impulse. What he wants to do, when he wants to do it. And we'll definitely go into that later on with what happens after the murders and how Danny Rowling acts before the murders. Like it all comes down to the fact that this man has probably the least amount of impulse control that I've ever heard of. And Richard Chase had more impulse control than Danny Rowling.
He wouldn't go into the locked houses.
I guess not.
He had some rules.
So Danny Rowling is playing positionless basketball. He's the center and the point guard. Antetokounmpo's taking the ball up the court. What's happening? He's 7 feet tall.
I was watching this interview with Danny Rowling. He was talking to a reporter. I forgot why they let him be in the room with this woman. But it's the, ma'am, Howdy, ma'am. Like him, like doing, giving everybody like right. a thank. He's being real cordial. Like she's like, I heard that the food here is, they don't want the secret out that the food here is not that bad. And he's just like, well, you know, it's not comparable to Mickey D's, you know? And like they were joking and shit. Right. And I was like, that man is a shapeshifter. Like that's a type of killer he is, where he's come to this room because he's got those sad eyes. Yeah. Like it really comes down to it. He's got those like puppy dog, like I'm sorry, like face that. It completely, she's horrifying. A total fucking unbridled maniac.
Horrifying.
Now, as far as quote-unquote inspiration for these murders went, Danny claimed to have kicked off the spree after watching a movie that had just been released in the theaters that eventually became a favorite among serial killers everywhere, including Jeffrey Dahmer. That movie was the George C. Scott vehicle, The Exorcist III. Arguably the most fun of all the Exorcist movies, partly because it also featured New York Knicks center Patrick Ewing as the Angel of Death in his one and only acting role in which he doesn't play Patrick Ewing.
But he doesn't have any lines. Well, you ever see that? He was sitting at a table.
What line do you want to
have? He played Patrick Ewing in Space Jam.
No, I know that, but he played a version of Patrick Ewing because in Space Jam they won.
He definitely could have said, they could have cut to him at some point and if him going like, you can't even buy a bucket. Like, it would have been nice if he gave him just one line.
That would have been nice for the poor guy. Exorcist 3, if you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. Not just for serial killers, okay?
No.
It is a really fun, scary movie.
It is. Now, the central plot to The Exorcist 3 is that the spirit of an executed serial murderer nicknamed the Gemini Killer and played by Brad Dourif in one of his best roles.
It's a great scene.
This serial killer is possessing people with the aid of the demon from the first Exorcist, the Master, and is using these possessed people to commit more murders. Now, The Exorcist 3 is fucking great. It's one of our favorites. It's one of my wife's favorite movies ever. But when Danny Rowling saw this movie in the theaters, he identified with the Gemini Killer. And since Danny's sign was Gemini, he figured that The Exorcist 3 was a sign that the killing should begin.
Oh, my God.
Or it's just him technically ripping off a movie. Like, in a way.
He's just a thief. He's a plagiarist. And that's the worst crime of all, other than all the other crimes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously a stupid fucking coincidence because Danny had gone to Gainesville specifically to kill. But what's interesting is that Gemini is indeed the most common serial killer sign, shared by Samuel Little, Jeffrey Dahmer, Arthur Shawcross, Jennifer Bianchi, Peter Curtin, David Berkowitz, and Richard Chase, amongst many, many others.
And I believe yesterday was the beginning of Gemini season. We're now in the Gemini season, and we're not trying to offend any Geminis.
Don't kill us.
Yeah, we're good men. We're good men. We have families.
That's the thing.
Leave us alone, Geminis.
If you offend a Cancer, then they just sit there and cry and wonder what they did wrong.
Yeah, it's cool. In that way.
Geminis are mad.
Geminis, they fucking kill you. They kill you in ornate ways.
Those are the ones. The Scorpios are the ones that you really got to watch out for.
They're full of passion. So all of the Gemini stuff really came to a head when he began his relationship with Sandra London, because he had been saying all this kind of shit. And Sandra London, who is a professional serial killer groupie, she went by the nickname of the Media Queen for a while, which was also the name of her production company.
That was Howard Stern's name also at one point.
she first dated a serial killer before a serial killer was a serial killer. She dated a man named Gerard Schaefer when she was a teenager. He was an older guy who arrived at her house. Like he became fascinated with her, and she was like immediately the first big titty goth girlfriend to exist. It was like Sandra London is that, where like Gerard Schaefer and her used to go to graveyards, and he used to tell her, he's like, I think about hanging women all the time, and like showed her all of his drawings of women hanging from trees and how he's going to stab them and shit. And her response was, you are the cutest boy I've ever seen. Dated him on and off for years.
Yeah. And Sandra, she has like, there's this great clip. She was in this Errol Morris documentary, this great clip, which is like, when I was a little girl, I imagined that the boogeyman came into my room on a pale horse and I rode away with him
in his black hat, black shirt, black pants, black socks.
Fucking unhinged.
Black shoes.
That's
black
scary, man.
Shoelaces. White skin.
He's on a black horse, and he takes me away from here. She's the only way to really describe it is that her eyes are like bay windows with like flames behind them. She is the scariest look. She's exactly when you say like ultimate serial killer groupie, you're exactly what you think that she looks like. Yeah. But she began a relationship where she broke up with Gerard Schaefer while he was in jail to be with Danny Rowling. Wow. And her and Danny Rowling formed this sort of symbiotic thing together, and then he gave her quote unquote the real story, which was that Gemini came in and took over his life. And then unfortunately the making of a serial killer begins with an introduction by Colin Wilson of Colin Wilson's The Occult, which I use all the time, and he tries to make the case that Gemini was real and was a demon, and he has a whole he tries to break down the demonology of it in the very beginning.
That's a swing and a miss. Colin Wilson's usually pretty good, but that is a swing and a miss, my friend.
He is obvious. He's a true believer.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So like, it is in character. But it definitely was a surprise.
Yeah. Interesting. Serial killer groupies can either look like Sandra London or Paula Deen. There's only two types, and I don't know why.
They're both very similar.
Isn't that odd?
And here is a selection from The Making of a Serial Killer that describes what it was like when Gemini took hold.
I don't.
I was resting on my iron bunk when this thing that appeared like a gargoyle pounced on my chest, pinning me to the mattress. It had both claws pressing against my shoulders. It released its grip on one of my shoulders and clawed open my mouth, snaking a foot-long slimy tongue down my throat. I couldn't breathe.
Is this Jared Fogle talking about his prison experience?
What is happening? And I began to struggle. I managed to push the thing far enough away from my face to get that horrible tongue out of my windpipe. It sneered and spat. How does it feel to kiss a snail? I scream,
what?
And it just disappeared.
And that then is- Colin Wilson tries to say that's the demonic entity coming on, and that oftentimes demonic entities throat you down into your windpipe.
That's just stolen. That reminds me of the scene from The Matrix, or when Tom Hardy was possessed by Venom in that horrible film. This man is not making anything. This is not creative.
He's making it up.
He's just stealing it all. I'm sure that he saw a movie scene very similar to that at some point.
Live from your grave.
Now, unlike most serial killers who have a cool-down period of weeks, months, or even years between murders, especially when they first began, Danny Rowling, having had almost no impulse control, had a cooling-off period of less than 24 hours. Before the first crime scene was even properly worked, Danny created the second. And this second crime scene is quite possibly the most horrifying crime scene that I've ever read about.
So I'd say if you don't smoke, go get a pack. You know, like really sit down with it. Maybe this is a good time to play a game of solitaire.
Ooh.
First, play a game of solitaire, drink five or six beers, then sit and listen.
Okay, unless you're sitting in a car actively driving. Don't do any of that.
Except get a pack of cigarettes. It's fun to smoke. It's fun to ride around in a car and smoke.
It's very dangerous.
I miss it. I do miss it. Yeah,
it's very dangerous. Mm-hmm.
So on Saturday, August 25th, Danny Rowling used his stolen screwdriver to pop open the latch on the sliding glass back door on the empty apartment of a college student named Krista Hoyt and hid behind a bookshelf until Krista got home. When she arrived at about 10 p.m., Danny leapt out and rained down his fists until Krista was knocked off balance. Then he duct taped her mouth and her arms before raping her for an hour, using his K-bar knife to stab her whenever he felt like it. Like almost all the others, Danny delivered the killing blow by turning her over on her stomach and plunging the knife into her back. But once she was dead, he rolled her back over and buried the knife in her belly, then sliced upward. Then he cut off her nipples and placed them on top of the exposed intestines before cutting off her breasts, wrapping them in a towel, and placing them next to the bed so he could take them away later. But the most horrific violation was when Danny Rowling decapitated the corpse using his razor-sharp K-bar knife with a clean, almost surgical cut. With the head removed, Danny set about creating a crime scene so horrendous it doesn't even seem real. First,
Danny positioned the headless body on the edge of the bed, midway between the foot and the headboard, then spread the legs wide apart while the arms drooped to the side and the intestines spilled out from a wound that went from belly to breastbone. Then Danny took the head and set it on the same bookcase he'd used to conceal himself, propped up by a wooden jewelry box and positioned in such a way that it looked as if the head was staring in horror at its own body.
Oh my gosh.
Finally, Danny set up a mirror so it was guaranteed that the first thing whoever discovered the crime scene saw when they opened the door was the decapitated head of a co-ed facing her own mutilated corpse.
Oh.
Danny then left, forgetting to take along the breasts and leaving behind the most gruesome crime scene in Florida history, far surpassing Ted Bundy's night of terror at the Chi Omega house.
And his rebuttal in the book, the only thing that he says about it, he's just like, I didn't adjust those mirrors.
That's the problem. That's what he says about it.
Yeah, that's where they got that wrong.
Oh, I see. But everything else was fairly accurate.
Yes.
Oh my God, that is so freaking brutal.
It's very
horrible. Yeah,
there's no embellishment on that. No, that all happened.
But
except for the fucking mirrors. I don't know.
I'm not gonna believe him.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know what it is about.
There's
him.
A couple of things that are weird about this, because not weird at all. Like, he did all of this, but he. There's one thing that he says in the book that he said that he did not originally decapitate her, that he had left and came back saying that he thought he'd left his wallet and that he came back and then re-entered into the crime scene. But to me, with that, again, that's Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
It's the same shit. He is modeling himself after Ted Bundy. He is consciously doing it. That puts him sort of in BTK like category where he believes himself to be like a serial killer expert.
And if he does see himself as the sequel to Ted Bundy, as we learned from the movie Scream, you got to have more blood in the sequel. And maybe that's why he went, above and beyond in this nasty way.
You know, what's interesting is that the Danny Rowling story was actually the inspiration for the Scream screenplay.
Oh, yeah. Is that right?
The guy who wrote the screenplay for Scream started writing it after seeing the news reports from the Gainesville Ripper murders.
Wow.
Well, and then when the reports of the state of the bodies came out, at first no one believed it. No one wanted to talk about it because obviously, the idea of like learning that somebody that you know, somebody that you love, has had this done to them physically.
Like, I can't.
For a while, because the cops didn't want to tell the families that this happened to their kids.
Well, did they not want to tell them because they didn't want to hurt the family emotionally, or was it because they wanted to keep some evidence secret that they could, so that Danny would only know the truth or whatever?
Both. They tried to do both, but then what they had to do was release. They took pictures of it.
Oh.
And they only like they had to be revealed in secret, where they had to go and view the pictures of the crime scenes in private.
So their parents had to go
if they wanted to.
Oh my God.
It was for the jurors. It was for the
This was during the trial.
Trial.
Do you get free health care after you're a juror on this?
No.
Do you get free therapy for life? Because I think you should get one free card for therapy for life.
Yes. I think so.
And McDonald's breakfast.
And weed like license. You know, here's weed. Here's some weed. Here you go. Go on a roller coaster and I'm sorry you're fucked.
Good God, I can't imagine being the juror on this case.
Now, one psychologist speculated that the reason why Danny positioned the bodies was because Danny knew that a cop would most likely discover the scene, and Danny wanted to spite all police officers, and therefore spite his abusive cop father. And sure enough, it was indeed a cop who found Krista Hoyt. She worked part-time at the Alachua County Sheriff's Office, so when she didn't show up for work on Monday, two deputies went on a welfare check. It was then that Gainesville discovered that they officially had a serial killer in their midst.
We got one!
Now, panic almost immediately hit the University of Florida campus. Parents took their children out of school, never to return. Campus radio stations started a campaign to get everyone to just fucking go home. And parents who couldn't get a hold of their kids tied up phone lines at the police station, trying to get cops to check on each and every student. And of course, there were plenty of theories as to who the killer could be. One prevalent rumor was that the Gainesville Ripper was a cop, which naturally made canvassing for information that much more difficult. Others thought that the Gainesville Ripper was most likely someone who blended in, a new neighbor or a new student, because this had all occurred right at the beginning of the school year. A lot of strangers in Gainesville.
Oh, yeah. It goes from like, I remember that one documentary said it's like, it goes from something like the town doubles in size when the college kids show up.
Yeah, same thing with Lubbock, where I went to college. Like, it's during the summer, it's fucking dead, and then all of a sudden, the whole fucking town comes alive.
Right.
Perhaps the most erroneous and stupid rumor, though, was that the killer was a pizza delivery man.
How fucking dare they?
Well, do we know it's not true?
Yes, we know it's not true. We know exactly who the fucking killer is.
Oh, I see.
And Ben, this damn near put every pizza delivery joint in Gainesville out of business. And that's not even counting all the lost trips to the drivers.
Well, all I know
lost
is...
tips. Honestly, when it comes down to it, wouldn't you want to give extra tips if you think the guy's going to kill you and your roommate?
Well, you could maybe use it for leverage. I worked at Jimmy John's. Big Pizza was our competition, so...
Hey,
whatever. Jimmy John's driver didn't do it.
Oh, hey, man. And I was a fucking Papa John's delivery driver in college, in a college town. So I fucking feel these guys' pain.
Pizza delivery people are some of the purest fucking first responders. The real respect. I mean, nurses.
Nurses were very important. They are very important. Thank you for all the nurses that listen.
Pizza delivery people were on the front lines every day during this.
How many peppuccinos did you steal, Marcus?
Oh, I didn't like peppuccinos. I didn't have to steal peppuccinos because the great thing about fucking Papa John's is that at the end of the day, everybody goes home with a fucking free pizza, at least in my store.
It'd be nice if they paid you, though.
Come on, that's it. What are we doing here? We're giving away money?
But really, those rumors circulated after Danny Rowling ended his reign of terror. Because remember, Krista Hoyt came the night directly after the first double murder.
Yes.
Oh my
and the second double murder came the very next night after Krista Hoyt. This all happened over the course of one fucking weekend.
Oh my God, this is a freaking horror movie.
Well, the night after the Krista Hoyt murder, Danny Rowling peeped into the windows of a unit at the Gatorwood Apartments and set his sights on student Tracy Pauls.
Snarped.
No snarping. No, snarping is too cute. It sounds like snarfing. It sounds like the fucking
Visault.
Big cute fat.
That was someone else. But someone else tweeted that at me. Visual assault.
Yeah, visual assault. Visually assaulted. Yes,
okay,
I like that.
Very good.
Now, Tracy didn't live alone. In fact, she had a roommate named Manuel Tabuada. And on the night that Danny Rowling came calling, Tabuada had just got home from his shift at Bennigan's, and everyone in the house was asleep by 3 a.m.
Is it weird that I know that Gainesville Bennigan's?
I mean, if you've been there.
Strange.
There was a big old Bennigan's in Gainesville, and I remember there was a big old Bennigan's in Tallahassee, and that got shut down because the health violations got to the point, which is like weird because nothing was shut down in Tallahassee for health violations because everything was run by 18-year-olds.
Right.
They just ran every business in the college town, but Bennigan's, I don't know what their crimes were. I knew not to eat there, ever.
All right.
So once all the lights were out, Danny jimmied the pin out of the sliding glass door with his screwdriver and entered the living room. Now, like most home invader serial killers, Danny opted to attack the male first to remove the most obvious threat. And Manuel Tabuada was indeed a threat physically, being a 6'3" former football player. So Danny slipped into Manuel's bedroom and plunged a knife into his chest so hard that it ripped through his solar plexus. But Manuel had an extraordinary will to live, and he fought back, even with a gaping chest wound.
Wow.
Danny swung the knife wildly, stabbing and cutting Manuel again and again until Manuel managed to restrain Danny with a bear hug. But the damage had been done, and with each second of blood loss, Manuel lost strength. After about a minute, Danny was able to pull away enough to stab Manuel in the chest. He pulled upward and hard, opening Manuel's chest and killing him. But it had still taken 31 stab wounds to take Manuel down.
Yeah, because he would need to attack a man with a surprise attack. With a surprise attack, because he was not Rambo, and he barely made it in the armed services.
Actually, he didn't make it in the armed services. He was given a dishonorable discharge, and it was the Air Force at that.
Mm.
And that was when Tracy Pauls entered the room. When she saw Manuel, she screamed and ran away to the bathroom, where she locked herself inside. But Danny kicked down the door and bound her with tape like he had almost all the rest.
He then raped her, stabbed her, and dragged her out to the hallway to pose her. But when he realized she was still alive, he wiped the blood off her face and raped her again until she died from her wounds. Now, for some reason, this seemed to satisfy whatever compulsions Danny had to defile the bodies of the people he killed. So instead of posing them, he haphazardly cleaned up the crime scene and walked out the way he'd come in.
This one, he said Gemini left him halfway through.
I see. He then jumped in the pool of a nearby apartment complex to wash off the blood, then buried his knife and his gloves next to an old chicken coop, thereby ending his weekend of terror. But just because Danny Rowling stopped murdering didn't mean that he stopped committing crimes. After taking a nap at his campsite following his last double murder, Danny Rowling woke up and robbed a bank at gunpoint on Monday morning.
Jeez.
Yeah, he's an adrenaline junkie. Total lack of impulse control, like we've been saying. And again, this is his evidence of, like, you see, Danny could never have done this. Only Enod could have done these crimes. I'm a bank robber.
Oh, I see. That's it, huh?
Honestly, first of all, I'm a singer. Second of all, I'm a lover. Third of all, I'm a bank robber. Fourth of all, I am a loyal customer of the U.S. Postal Service.
Very nice.
Reportedly, while the tellers were stuffing bags of cash during that bank robbery, Danny yelled, quote,
"There better not be any dye packs in here."
And sure enough, 50 yards from the bank, a witness saw a pink dye pack explode in Danny's face when he tried opening the bag.
Scootin', yippity-doo.
Mondays, huh?
Soon after, Danny made fast friends with another drifter type named Tony Danza.
That's a cool version of Tony Danza.
I don't think that's the cool. I think Tony Danza is the cool version of Tony Danza.
And Danny quickly began bragging about the bank he just robbed. But when the cops pulled up on the two men, Danny ran and Tony Danza very quickly led the cops to the pink dyed money at Danny's campsite.
It's right over here. I'm sorry, this is John Travolta. I don't know why I did that. Oh, it's your big money over here, officers. Oh, hey, oh.
It's close. I could see it happening. I could see that Tony Danza sounding like that.
But even though the campsite held the ski mask Danny wore during the crimes, the screwdriver Danny had used to gain access to all three crime scenes, and the tapes Danny recorded, which hinted towards a big upcoming crime spree, no one in the Gainesville Police Department thought to make the connection.
What?
And all of this shit just went into a bag in the evidence closet.
That's how it is, because they I mean, they are not good at it.
They are
Gainesville police.
Yeah. Shouldn't they be very good at solving murder?
No, they're very good at gaining weight.
Yeah. It's the Gainesville Police Department. They're very good at, like, breaking up, like, beer busts.
Yeah, dude.
But they fuck up this murder investigation at every turn until someone else solves it for them.
God forbid you light up a joint. You'll go right to jail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, these crimes happen too quick. That's the problem.
I'm with you. And of course, a beer bust, fantastic term for Angela Merkel.
Yeah, buddy.
There it is. She's got a beer bust. Yeah. Angela Merkel, we'll be there.
Give me some of what she's having.
Wow, leadership. Leadership. And she's very smart. She's a scientist.
Now, of course, the media immediately began a frenzy after five grotesque murders occurred in a college town over a single weekend.
Yeah.
And this being 1990, the murders very quickly got rolled into the satanic panic.
Just fucking eat me with this satanic panic bullshit.
Whoa, bro. Eat me. Take it easy. This is still a PG-13 show.
Shorts.
Whoa! Yeah. Whoa!
Well, conveniently, the more hysterical news outlets blamed The Exorcist 3.
Oh my God. And it wasn't even the most successful of the fucking trilogy.
No, it really wasn't.
And while Exorcist 3 was tangentially related, the media was entirely unaware that the killer was a committed Christian who had walked away from one of his double murders singing "Nearer My God to Thee."
Also, why didn't they blame George Michael? You know, you make a hit and you don't realize, you don't know what it's going to be used for. That's why we preface every song that we make with "Don't kill to this song," and now here it is.
It's important. That's how you got your cover yourself legally.
Legally.
As far as the students went, most refused to sleep alone, and some even crowded in groups of 10 to 20 students, each one taking turns staying awake.
Wow.
There was no more partying, no one went out to the bars, and parents pressured the school to cancel class. In other words, Gainesville simply stopped, and police were under enormous pressure to find a suspect.
Very similar to the Summer of Sam, like that whole thing with the idea of like, it changed the culture of a whole city.
Yeah, but perhaps a more pressing reason besides commerce was the fact that the rapid pace in which the murders occurred suggested that another murder could happen at any time. So, after canvassing the areas around the three crime scenes, cops found a young man named Edward Humphrey, who had just been kicked out of the complex across the street from the Gatorwoods apartments a week earlier for, quote-unquote, acting crazy.
Edward Humphrey, to me, he reminds me a great deal of Eddie, Meatloaf's character from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where he's a unfortunate-looking man that happened to be in the right place, wrong time.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Ed Humphrey was an unfortunate human being who tragically looked like a stereotypical fictional serial killer from the movies. He was 6 foot tall, 200 pounds, and had actual Joker type scars all over his face, owing to a car accident, which had sent Ed flying through a windshield.
And he had like crazy eyes. He's like exactly what you think. It's like big googly eyes that are like off center of each other. In every picture, it looks like he's about to attack you or he's very scared, you know? Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Edward Humphrey had been trying to make friends right before the murders by simply walking to the apartments of strangers. And if they just shooed him out and locked him out of the apartment, he'd sit there and stare through their windows until they closed the curtains.
Can I come inside?
It's sad.
I mean, that's how most people I met in Tallahassee arrived into my friend group.
Yeah.
They just wandered into a party. You know what I mean? And there's all of a sudden they're like, it's like, oh, you guys all know Reggie. And they're like, no, like, is Reggie in school with you? And it's like, no, I thought in any of my classes, any of your classes? No. It's been like, how'd we know that 40-year-old man?
You guys are cool guys. Cool guys.
Yeah, he always brought like a handle of whiskey, and then every once in a while, like he'd say something weird to the girls, and you have to go, hey, Reggie, you're getting kinda edgy, you know, like, oh, it's edgy Reggie, and then
edgy
he
Reggie.
Dies, you know, and then he always just ends up dead.
Yeah, of course. You have a lot of explaining to do. So it seems like this guy just, he lacked nuance on how to meet people.
Well, he also told a security guard at the Gatorwoods complex that God had told him to kill the guard, and neighbors complained that Ed had loud fights with himself in his apartment.
Nowadays, you could just say he's a streamer.
Yeah.
Now, there was a very good reason for Ed's behavior. He was afflicted with bipolar disorder, type 1 from the sound of it, and he'd gone off his meds just prior to the Gainesville Ripper murders.
What do you think, Marcus, if you went off your meds, what would the argument with yourself be about?
Well, first of all, I'm bipolar 2, not bipolar 1. I'm not really the delusions of grandeur. I'm more like a bipolar 2. It's more like, you said this before, it's depression premium. It's depression plus.
Oh, okay. It's the Batman Returns. Yeah.
No, the last argument that I had with myself when I was in a bipolar state, when I was in a manic state, was whether or not strangers could read my mind when I was on the street. And was it really safer on the train because I was in a big metal tube? I don't know.
Interesting.
It was hard to tell, but I mean, you know, that was the hypothesis.
It's hard when you're your own devil's advocate.
It is. Point, counterpoint.
Well, as such, Ed Humphrey was having delusions of grandeur right around the time that Danny Rowland came to town. And this being around the time of Operation Desert Storm, Ed was telling people that he was going to join the Army Rangers specifically so he could go to Kuwait and commit consequence-free murder.
Technically, if you told that to a recruiter, he would have went to right to the top of the list.
Right to the top. Absolutely. Front lines.
Ed was also pretty free with telling people that Satan was after him, and he wore special gardening gloves and a special sash to repel the Dark Lord.
Oh, okay. Well, should work. Yeah, that's what Nighthorse told me that I should do in order to avoid the IRS.
I agree. Wear a special sash. Don't tax me, man.
Then about...
And you have to say it just like
don't
that.
Tax me, bro. Don't tax me, bro.
Don't tax me.
Then, about a month before the murders, Ed was seen in a surf shop, threatening to cut the hearts out of everyone in the store.
Whoa, dude, that's not mahalo, bro.
That is not mahalo. No. Also, is there a lot of surfing happening in Gainesville? Do people go surfing on the weekend?
It's 4 hours to the beach, yeah. Okay. No, it's the worst part of the type of Florida to be in because there's no access to any form of water.
Hear me out, Becky. Surf shop. Gainesville.
Another time, a police officer found Ed outside of an Air Force base running around in circles while chewing on a beer can. And when the officer finally told him to stop, Ed told him that he was going to join the military so he could cut people up and gut them like deers.
Eddie's a funny guy.
He's just having a nice time. What do you mean chewing on a beer can?
Chewing on a beer can.
Chewing, like he's literally a goat? Chewing.
Yeah. Yeah. Ed also used to bother a medical student working a day job at Krispy Kreme during her shift to ask if she ever took body parts or skin home from her anatomy class to, quote unquote, mess around with it.
There's a lot of people that are going to have a hard time flirting after the pandemic. And it sure. just is kind of what it sounds like. If you're already crazy and you're just trying to think of something to say and you just got done chewing on a fucking beer can and yelling at the police officers, and you'll be like, let me ask you a question about you. Do you ever take skin home to play around with it? I'm trying to know about you.
Oh my God. You say that sentence now, you're going to find yourself a wife. Be very careful because people like that stuff.
They do.
Marcus, you've taken skin home. You've taken the whole thing home before. I mean, it's very dangerous.
I've never been a recipient of skin. I've taken a lot of human bones home, but I've never been a recipient of skin.
Nice. I apologize.
Yeah, yeah. Really, there
I'm
is
so sorry.
But what was most damning for Ed was that while Danny Rowling was in the midst of his murderous rampage, Ed was having a particularly public bipolar break in Gainesville that attracted all the wrong kinds of attention. On the night that Danny killed Sonia Larson and Christina Powell, Ed was walking around Gainesville huffing gas. At one point, he walked.
He was zigzagging around Gainesville.
Yeah, he was best. He was doing his own serpentine race.
Wow.
At one point, Ed walked into a Roy Rogers where Ed paid for a single biscuit with 35 cents and a baseball cap.
At one point, he walked into a Roy Rogers, which really takes me back because a Roy
this
Rogers.
This whole thing is not just about restaurants you went to. Why? This is.
Roy Rogers is for.
What about Roy Rogers?
If you're hungry after huffing a bunch of gas.
I don't think you are hungry after huffing a bunch of gas.
Danny was.
Well, the Roy Rogers accepted the barter pretty much just to get rid of him, but Ed returned an hour later wearing a different baseball cap with four more baseball caps stuffed in his pockets. Because he figured out some sort of fucking barter system loophole.
This is where I got you. This is where I got you, bro.
They took it. I mean, it worked the first time. What do you want from this guy?
Because then, you know, he puts one, he's just like, can I have a hamburger, please? It's like, one baseball cap in here. Just take this for yourself. Just another baseball cap. Like, you can keep that. Don't spend it all in one place, huh?
Oh, my God. Maybe for a fanny pack, he could get some French fries.
Well, once they got rid of him again, Ed went to a bar called the Central City Lounge, but was denied entry because he didn't have any ID. And after being turned away, Ed pointed at the bouncer and the manager and reportedly said, quote,
"You're all dead. Bingo, bingo, bongo. You're all dead. My people are going to come back and I'm going to get you. I'm the middleman for some drug dealer. I could cut your fucking throat and you wouldn't even know it."
I can't believe he said bingo, bongo, bango like that, because that's how you summon an elderly woman. Wow.
No, bingo, bango, bongo. I don't want to leave the Congo. Bingo, bango, bongo. I don't want to leave the Congo. No, 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 no. It's an old song.
Oh, wow.
It's an old song, huh?
Yeah, it's an old song.
No Dogs in Space.
No kidding. I ran into a few fans of yours, by the way, the other night.
Oh, really?
They wouldn't stop talking about how much they loved the show.
Oh, that's...
No, truly, they do love. No Dogs in Space. Great. Everyone check it out. Yes, they loved, they loved all the punk. Much, yeah. And they loved the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, the Beastie Boys. Actually, we just released this week, released Beastie Boys Part 5. This is when we get to talk about Paul's Boutique.
Oh, very nice.
Best Beastie Boy album there is. Back to Ed. Then turned to some students across the street and shouted, quote,
"I'm on recon. Don't you mess with me. Don't look at me. I could kill you guys. You ain't shit."
Well, Ed, recon would imply that you're going to be quiet. And you are very loud. Most people on recon don't scream, "I am on recon." It's like, "I'm an undercover cop." You understand how that would be a problem.
I want all of you to know I am employed as a reconnaissance officer.
Okay.
And you're all the subjects of my recon.
You want to keep that more quiet next time.
After that, Ed went to the Krispy Kreme where he bothered the medical student by extensively and immediately talking about Ted Bundy upon his arrival and ended the conversation by saying he'd like to stalk women with knives.
I said I'd like to. Jeez. I said I'm not saying I'm doing it, but this is technically what I did.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, you did do this, but except you did this at the actual location where Ted Bundy murdered all of the sorority girls. Yeah.
Oh, no, you were at a party. You weren't stalking people at Krispy Kreme and Bennigan's and,
well, I didn't
and
view
Roy
them
Rogers.
As, that wasn't stalking. That was me being a great customer.
Exactly.
Now, Ed stayed quiet for the rest of the weekend, but on Monday, he called his grandmother screaming that he'd lost his car, and because of this, Ed would have to drop out of school. Now, the grandmother called the police to do a welfare check on Ed, but once they arrived, he told them that he didn't care about the car anymore because he decided he was going to Panama to fight Manuel Noriega.
Sweet. Oh, of course.
But then Ed Humphrey made a grave mistake by mentioning the Gainesville Ripper murders. And even though the murders were all anyone in town was talking about, cops still took it as a sign that Ed Humphrey might have something to do with it. They then began investigating Ed and found out about all the crazy violent talk Ed had been spreading around town, including another incident in which Ed had talked about wanting to cut a nipple off a girl.
That wasn't about murder. That was about my collections.
That is very scary, Ed.
Now, all this hearsay wasn't enough to arrest Ed, but on August 30th, a few days after the last murder, Ed had a complete break and attacked his grandmother. He was arrested for aggravated battery and thereafter became the number one suspect in the Gainesville Ripper murders. When cops got him in the box, they questioned him for 24 hours straight without an attorney present, when he was obviously in a fucking manic state. And right. Since he was in a manic state, Ed was highly suggestible and eager to talk about all manner of mutilations, knifings, and dismemberments. Pretty soon, the media caught on, and when they publicly named Ed Humphrey as the Gainesville Ripper, police did absolutely nothing to correct the claim. And Ed, all of a sudden, he was the Gainesville Ripper. This fucking poor guy going through a fucking bipolar episode. He was, and the cops are like, yeah. No, he's definitely our guy. And there's no evidence whatsoever.
So if you're Donnie Rowling at this point, you must be happier than a pig in a bunch of crap.
I honestly don't even.
This is the greatest cover ever.
Weirdly, I don't think he was even paying attention to the news.
No.
Like, Danny Rowling,
he didn't read his own press.
Not till later. So. No, he truly was deeply, deeply impulsive. And I don't think he was following the news because he just started robbing banks immediately. Marcus, I have a question about this type of bipolar freakout.
Sure. I'm not an expert by any means, but I can give my personal experience.
But when people like
Marcus, do I look like a teapot to you right now?
No,
he's not having a fit.
When people have these breakdowns, like, is it like in how in Tourette's, how people say, like, one thing about Tourette's is that sometimes the tics want you to say things that are specifically, like, inappropriate for the situation? Or, like, is it the fixations on stuff that's, like, really uncomfortable and, like, fucked up, dark stuff? Is it just about that, where you're following sort of, like, an intrusive thought, where you're saying these kind of scary things in your own mind to people? Or, why would he go so dark? If he wasn't maybe an inherently violent person, I just wonder. It's more of a question.
Well, I mean, everybody follows everybody follows whatever their delusion is. Like, for example, our friend John F. O'Donnell, who's talked many, many times in stand-up sets and podcasts about his bipolar break. Like, he thought that he was Jesus and he went to go live on a fucking abandoned gambling boat in the East River.
Sure.
You know, like, so it's like they're the
delusions. That was his storyline.
That was his storyline, yes. And Ed Humphrey's storyline seemed nowhere near as poignant. Like, it didn't really have as much of a point. Like, he was just sort of going off in all directions.
Yeah.
But it does seem like Ed Humphrey, I mean, he did have a little bit of violence in him. I mean, at one point during his break, he did attack his grandmother. He did beat up his own fucking grandmother.
Yeah.
So really, it's kind of following whatever your thing is at the time. You know, whether it be paranoia, whether it be delusions of grandeur, this or that or whatnot. But for some reason, Ed Humphrey's line was violence. Definitely. He was talking constantly about violence.
Yeah, it's like when Night Horse comes to me, I always wanted to go to whatever I could find, the best local dives. these drive-ins that you go into, and these, I bet it's kind of my favorite type of thing. Rib stick in restaurants that you can only get in certain little neighborhoods.
You can almost put that on a flip-flop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was in a bipolar break, it was usually paranoia. Like, it was straight up paranoia. Other people are out to get me, and so on and so forth. But it was never super specific because I wasn't bipolar one. I'm bipolar two.
Maybe it was a surveillance state, bro.
Well, we could talk about that for hours.
No, it was more supernatural, weird thing. I don't want to get too far into it, but I've been medicated for 15 years, and I'm good.
You're looking tight.
Live from your grave.
Well, meanwhile, the FBI was telling Gainesville police that Ed Humphrey probably wasn't their guy. So the FBI had gotten pretty goddamn good at behavioral analysis by 1990, and their profile of the Gainesville Ripper sounded nothing like Ed Humphrey and everything like Danny Rowling. Mm. They said that the killer would be between 25 and 35, from a poor background, abused physically, sexually, and or psychologically during his formative years, would perceive himself to be a failure, would need to feel special, and would want to be a celebrity. It's Danny Rowling to a fucking T.
The problem is that these cops gonna listen to these nerds from Virginia.
The FBI? I mean, they're pretty big
this
time.
This is the problem,
there.
Though. They're like, we got our guy because he's got scars on his face.
Yeah.
That's a good
because
point.
They think they are operating off of a pop culture view of a serial killer. They're operating off like, oh, that's what a serial killer looks like. That's what a serial killer acts like. This guy has to be a serial killer. And on the other thing too is that the murders had stopped. So after Ed Humphrey was already in jail, no more murders. So they figured like, oh, this definitely is the guy then.
Okay.
And the only other suspect they had was some jerk off with quote unquote satanic type tattoos named Stephen Bates, who'd used a butcher knife during an armed robbery of a woman's home. And when they searched that guy's house, they found satanic writings, whatever the fuck that means, medical tape, bloodied clothing, drawings of women and poses similar to the victims, porn, knives, and a book on Jack the Ripper.
They just found your office.
No, that's a fucking average home of a Last Podcast on the Left fan, I'd say.
Sure.
Look around, you listeners at home, look around the room that you're fucking sitting in right now.
No,
how many of these things have you seen?
No one who has covered in blood clothes. No one should have clothes covered in blood just randomly laying around their house. Most people don't.
You think it's blood, and it turns out it's raspberry jam because you had a breakfast explosion.
I do
remember because Lexi, Holden's wife, was beautiful and wonderful, but I forget she's Christian. You know what I mean? Mm. And she walked into the studio and had to cross herself when she walked in. I was just like, oh yeah, I forget all this imagery to some people is incredibly frightening.
Oh yeah. No. I once had a cleaning lady at my house leave 2 hours early after trying to clean my office and failing.
I explained to our handyman that the devil is good.
Very nice. Very fun day for the handyman.
But even though Steven actually seemed to be a better suspect than Ed, police stuck with the guy who fit their idea of a serial killer. And Ed was held on $1 million bail for assaulting his grandmother.
Oh.
Now, police thought that since the murders had stopped, it meant that Ed Humphrey was their guy, even though they didn't have a single bit of evidence outside of the fact that Ed was weird, off his meds, and kind of annoying.
Oh, no, I'm going to get arrested for murder.
Absolutely. Judge, yeah, there is no evidence in the case, but look how ugly this motherfucker is.
I used to be fat. Now I'm weird, fat, skinny. I got Polish knees.
But really, Danny Rowling could have resumed killing at any time. On the same day that Ed Humphrey was arrested, Rowling broke into an apartment, ate cookies and Quaker oatmeal, watched a porno tape, and stole a 1978 Buick Regal.
He was for certain just about to kill again. There is no way he wasn't going to kill again.
Yeah.
No. He just did. The only reason why he didn't kill is because he didn't feel like it yet. From there, Danny left Gainesville for Tampa, where he drank heavily and smoked a whole bunch of crack.
Hey, you know, breakfast of champions.
Yeah, if you're going to do it in Tampa. He then continued burglaries and robberies, and Danny was almost killed by police during an escape from a crime scene in which Danny's car was hit by 17 bullets.
Jesus fucking Christ.
And Danny kept having weird encounters with normal people. On September 4th, he approached an artist and offered her $100 to do his portrait. She was actually charmed enough to invite him back to her place, where they ate Chinese food and watched Good Morning Vietnam on VHS without incident.
No kidding. Weird encounters with normal people. That's actually the name of our television show.
Hey, man, honestly.
That'd be great.
But it is weird because you see throughout all of the making of a serial killer, you have all of these stories where he really thought of himself as very charming. And yeah.
I don't fully
put it
see
out there.
It.
I don't know. No. Women used to go with home with him all the time, which is why he tried to maintain that he was innocent for fucking years. Because he's kept being like, you know, like it says here, it's just like the appendices of the making of a serial killer. It has stuff like, it says, no sodomy, no superstar, no knife play. I enjoy sex. This is what it says on here. Not gay is a whole chapter.
Not gay is a whole chapter. Okay.
From there, Danny burglarized a house in Tampa and robbed a Winn-Dixie in Ocala. But Danny's luck was about to run out. He left the Winn-Dixie with $4,700. This was, unfortunately for Danny, a training day for the Ocala Police Department.
Ocala. Yeah, it has to sound bad. It's Florida. That's how you know Ocala. It's a Florida town, because it has to sound like shit.
Therefore, when Winn-Dixie employees called 911 to report the robbery, there were twice as many cops on the streets as usual.
Oh.
So by the time Danny got into the driver's seat of the Ford Mustang he'd just stolen, cops were already pulling into the supermarket parking lot.
Man, he did not waste a fucking day. He is an adrenaline fucking monster.
And you know, one sergeant looked over at a trainee and was like, not every day is this fun. Don't get used to it.
We get to shoot our guns.
Yeah, we're going on a chase.
Yeah, it was a high-speed chase with a 1983 Ford Mustang. That's a fast fucking car.
Honestly. Yeah.
What a hell of a day to train.
Danny then abandoned the Mustang after wrecking it, shirtless for some reason. He'd taken his shirt off at one point.
Well, you're going to want to do that. You don't want to have any identifiable.
It's extra weight.
Yeah, it's extra weight. You want to shed that shirt.
And he ran into a business called Dial America Marketing, hoping to lose the cops. But when Danny ran out the back door into the rear parking lot, the cops were waiting. He dodged the first one, but the second one took him down. And when he was brought back to the Winn-Dixie for identification, he said, quote,
yeah, it's me, and I'm sorry.
Oh, my God, I'm going to kill this man.
But do you
he
think
also
that
was trying to run and hide, and he ran into a place that has dozens of phones. I don't think he wasn't thinking, was he?
I don't think he was thinking. The shirtless run from the cops through a telemarketing office officially makes him from Florida. And not
he gets
this,
he's
from
a citizen
Louisiana.
Now?
Yeah.
He's officially a resident?
Meanwhile, cops back in Gainesville were being forced to accept that Ed Humphrey was not the Ripper. See, Danny Rowling hadn't been as careful as he thought he'd been cleaning up the murder scenes, and he'd left behind a healthy amount of DNA. So when the crime scene DNA didn't match to Ed Humphrey, cops were forced to rule him out. But seemingly out of spite, the judge in his assault case still gave Ed Humphrey the maximum sentence of 22 months in the Florida Mental Hospital in Chattahoochee.
Yeah, they just decided he needed to be in a concrete square.
I mean, if he was in a hospital, hopefully he got some treatment. I'm not sure how good the hospital was, but
who knows?
It might be the best option.
But just as it seemed as if the investigation was hitting a dead end, a detective from Shreveport came calling with a possible connection between the Gainesville Ripper murders and the still unsolved Grissom family murders from the year before. See, when the news in Gainesville broke, a member of Danny Rowling's old church named Cindy Dobbin came forward and told the detectives that Danny Rowling might be the guy they wanted in both killings. From what Cindy said, Rowling used to hang out with her and her husband. But one night, as they were all enjoying a drink or two, her husband very suddenly came up to her, pointed at Danny, and said, quote,
this guy's gotta go. Which is how this is what happens when you just collect random friends sometimes that you meet at the bar. It's a natural cycle of the bar friendship.
This is a church friendship. They met at church.
But then they started drinking. You know, in my mind, it's the same. It's all the same. Similar.
It's like, you know, cheers.
You meet somebody, you first, you're like, oh, this is a fun guy. Why don't we not like this guy all the time? And then all of a sudden he's like, you know, he becomes your number one friend and he's there all the time. And then always something happens.
What did Danny say to him?
When she asked why, her husband said that Danny had told him in casual conversation that he likes to stick knives in people.
It's how I know where my knives are.
Like, when you say, were they wearing khakis? Casual conversation. He just brought it up out of nowhere?
No, casual conversation. They're just talking. They're
just like, chit-chatting, like, and then he's like, just like, I like to stab people.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh, that guy's got to go.
This is what happens.
Danny had also told Cindy that one day he was going to leave Shreveport for a place where he could lay in the sun and watch beautiful women all day long. And Cindy made the connection. That sounds a hell of a lot like Gainesville. So after seeing that the Grissom case and the Gainesville murders had multiple similarities, investigators managed to obtain one of Danny's teeth that a dentist had kept a hold of for one reason or another. I don't fucking know why.
Disgusting ass dentist. That's scary for me. The dentist shouldn't be keeping these teeth. You should be throwing that teeth out. I'm glad they had it for this reason, but still.
Does he have a lot of other teeth? Or did he just like Danny's
teeth? How can he tell the difference?
I don't know.
I guess he kept it in a drawer. It was tooth of Danny Rowling.
What did he do? He just fucking pulled out of a guy's head and threw it in a drawer like it was a rubber band?
You never want to hear your dentist say, that's a keeper. Now this one is mine.
And once the
one for you, one for me. One for you.
May I have all of them back, please?
And once the tooth was tested against the DNA found at the Gainesville Ripper crime scenes, Danny Rowling was found to be a match.
All right.
And once that was matched, cops returned to the evidence room and matched the ski mask and the screwdriver found at Danny's campsite to the crime scenes as well. And much to the relief of the investigators involved, they soon found that Danny Rowling was already in custody in Ocala.
Again, you just always make it sound the most ignorant.
I like Ocala. Doesn't sound that bad. Ocala.
Ocala. Yeah.
Ocala. Yeah.
Ocala. He was in Ocala for a string of felonies. The fucking Gainesville police didn't solve this shit. Fucking Cindy did. Cindy Dobbin did.
Wow.
Cindy figured this shit out.
Thank you, Cindy.
From church.
I don't think she was a busybody. I think that she had good evidence here to think that this Danny character was up to no good.
And as far as Ed Humphrey went, he actually had somewhat of an inspiring story. After being released from the hospital, he turned his entire life around, despite the fact that he was never officially pulled from the Gainesville Ripper suspect list. In fact, the media literally killed Ed Humphrey's grandmother. A journalist wouldn't stop banging on her door in November of 1991, long after Danny Rowling was fingered as the Gainesville Ripper. And when Ed's grandmother finally opened the door in a rage, she dropped dead in her front yard from a coronary.
Holy fucking shit. Man. I didn't know that there was an actual death by mass media.
Yeah.
I guess there is. Leave this woman alone.
It's too late.
But even so, Ed got back on his meds. And by the age of 28, he graduated magna cum laude from the University of Central Florida with a business degree. And this was after he'd made his way there from community college, all while working full-time jobs throughout. It's a bipolar success story.
Wow. All right. Good for you, weird looking Ed. Nice job.
Yeah. No, and he actually, unfortunately, Ed actually died a couple of weeks ago. Rest in peace, Ed Humphrey. Spent his entire life in Gainesville. But apparently, it was early April when Ed Humphrey died. So rest in peace, Ed Humphrey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a strange synchronicity, isn't it?
It is. Though?
But Gemini season.
That sounds scary now.
But concerning the charging of Danny Rowling for the Gainesville Ripper murders, Danny had already racked up 4 life sentences for the insane amount of violent felonies he'd committed immediately after the murders. What was doubly fucked was that when Danny's father, James, found out that his son had been charged with these horrific crimes, he was happy and said that he hoped the state fried his sorry bastard of a son.
Oh, it's because he always knew. Right? Even though he was always a piece of shit. That was his thing, is that like he didn't understand that he might have had a hand in it.
Yeah,
creating this monster. Yeah. You know what I mean? But he always knew that Danny was a monster.
Apparently, James Rowling fully witnessed his grandfather slit his mother's throat at the kitchen table right in front of him.
A lot of trauma.
And multiple people in the family went away to mental institutions for violent mental health issues. Wow. The Rowling family's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, that's a hell of a genealogy timeline there.
Yeah. Now, Danny knew that he was buffaloed due to the DNA evidence, so he began confessing to every single murder and apologizing again and again for every single one. But in a way to keep a weird amount of control over the situation, Danny said he had to confess in a very specific way.
Instead of just telling an investigator, Danny confessed through a fellow inmate named Bobby Lewis, who had, in the past, literally walked off death row by stealing a correctional officer's uniform and popping a fake mustache on his face.
Yeah, apparently they sentenced me to death for being a sketch comedian.
Whoa!
But yeah, wow. It was this weird thing because he still wants to distance himself from his own crimes. So he created this sort of intermediary where so then he doesn't have to, quote unquote, become out, like he doesn't have to be guilty. He comes through to somebody else's story of him that he's saying, and he can always kind of distance himself.
Yeah.
And that's why it's interesting he didn't read the media, because then he also gets like, well, they're talking about me. It's strange. I mean, I guess he probably got into his own story after he was incarcerated. I'm sure there wasn't a lot to do.
Well, he found the romanticism of it. That's right. What we keep talking about. We talked about it more last episode, but the making of a serial killer is really all about what he viewed as he's an outlaw. And that's why he wanted to separate it, because Danny was a bank robbing outlaw that just was, he lived with his guitar and his rucksack and nothing else mattered. But it was Gemini, they made him do all these horrible things. But you read this book and you really see the story of somebody who did not want to acknowledge just how out of control his fantasies have become.
Yeah. And what's really interesting about Danny Rowling, and it really speaks to his compartmentalization, is that he never hurt anyone when he was committing an armed robbery. Never once.
He was apologizing. He was always apologizing, saying, "Sorry, I have to do this. Pray for me." That was his like line, was like, as he'd go, like, every time he'd leave, he would go and be like, "I wouldn't do it if I didn't need it."
I mean, all of the apologizing probably really led the police astray, because they were looking for a Canadian. But it was him. I'm sorry.
It's not real.
I'm sorry.
Now, Bobby Lewis, the guy that Danny Rowling used to confess, he was actually the guy who introduced Danny to Sandra London, although he didn't tell Danny that the whole thing had started as a way for Sandra and Bobby to pump Danny Rowling for whatever profits they could make off of his crimes and confessions.
I think you mean fight for his free speech rights, because if you read Sandra London's intro to this book is all about how the unconstitutional Son of Sam laws, and how dare they take the microphone away from these wonderful white men, like, because they need to be able to be heard. Like, Danny Rowling's must be heard from.
Yeah, but pretty soon Sandra had forgotten all about Bobby Lewis and had focused completely on Danny Rowling. They began corresponding, and Sandra claimed to have fallen in love with Florida's most brutal serial killer. But after Sandra was denied visitation rights, she wrote this letter to Danny, which is absolutely real and not embellished in any way whatsoever.
"I've been in love before, but it was never like this. The first kind of love I felt was maternal. I loved little Danny. I wanted to make him my own child, where he could grow and be all that was in him to become. I wanted to shield him and protect him and play with him. Then came the thrill of the creative interplay. Yes, knowing you has lit a fire in the artist in me that is burning higher and higher. And I love that feeling, don't you? I know you feel exactly the same way, inspired. Slowly, I began to see you as 200 pounds a hard man. And that was another kind of love. That's the one that became so dizzying when I finally laid eyes on my gorgeous hunk of masculinity. And to be told I will never see you again. This is tearing me up. Darling, I wonder, would you like to get married?"
Oh my God, that is the single sweetest letter I have ever read to a serial killer.
And in response to this, Danny Rowling actually sang a song to Sandra London during the sentencing for one of his many armed robbery hearings. And luckily for us, that serenade was actually filmed.
"I recall the day I first saw you. I reached out to say I love you. But it was hard to say. I couldn't touch you. Tell me, baby, what were my words? All my tears run together.
Excuse me, Mr. Rollins.
Down
Mr.
the path you choose
Mr. Rollins.
To follow.
Mr. Rollins.
Tell me, baby, what were my words? All my tears run together. What were my words? All my tears run together, baby. Just like rain.
Okay, you get one song and that's it, Mr. Rollins.
You get one song.
I think that judge improvised that, because I don't think a lot of people get one song.
Well, and
I'm going to demand my one song if I'm ever incarcerated in Florida. Be like, that motherfucker got a song. I'm going to sing a song too.
Oh, of course.
And I'm mighty proud of this ragged old flag.
The way she's looking at him, the only way
she
you describe
scary,
it,
bro.
She's very scary. Yeah. She looks like Miss Piggy looking at Kermit, where she's like, oh, Kermit.
No, that's innocent love, Henry. No, she looks like the sister from one of the villains from Children Under the Stairs or People Under the Stairs. Yeah. She looks like she collects kids and skin.
Well, part of the reason why that was so powerful for them as a moment was because they have never been allowed to be in the same room. And that was, she arrived at the press conference, and so she was allowed to be without a plate glass between them for the first time. So it became this, like, he took this as his moment to express his love for her.
And the whole time his lawyer is like tapping him on the arm saying like,
this is dumb.
Shut the fuck up. This is dumb. Stop it. You're making it worse. You're making it a lot worse.
How much worse can it get?
He gives a little wink to his, he goes like, check this out. Like right before he starts singing, like you know, like when you go up right before an open mic night being like, all right, prepare to be wowed. He just does it.
Do any gas pumps work in this country?
You didn't even use it on stage.
I know.
Now, Danny knew that he didn't have a shot at a not guilty verdict, not even not guilty by reason of insanity. So he pled guilty to all five murders. And interestingly, when he pled guilty, his lawyer was the infamous Stephen Glazer, who some might remember as the bare-chested, disturbingly hairy lawyer from Nick Broomfield's Eileen Wuornos documentary.
That's right.
Wow, what a crazy coincidence. This guy has
It's a small true crime world.
Well, he's a Florida lawyer. You know, this is all Florida. This is all the same area of Florida.
Right, right. So I guess it's not so coincidental that a lot of people got murdered in Florida.
Now, Danny said he pled guilty because he, quote, wanted to do the right thing.
But really,
Danny's guilty plea was just a long shot to avoid the death penalty, which absolutely did not work.
Judge, hear me out. The name of this song is called Change of Heart.
I didn't do it. Yes, I did. I didn't do it. Yes, I did.
Mr. Rowling, we gave you one song. That is two songs, sir.
Danny was given a death sentence for all five murders. And after they were read in open court, Sandra London blew Danny a kiss. And Danny gave her a sullen nod before being led out of the courtroom. But soon after, Sandra released a copyrighted statement on Danny's behalf saying he was glad to be sentenced to death. In part, it read, quote,
once it was done, I felt as if a big, hairy, smelly ape jumped off my shoulders and I could be human again. God bless Gainesville and Lord help heal its people. Amen.
Good. Wow. What a douchebag. And if you're one of the relatives of the victims, fuck you, man.
Oh, yeah. He said the whole end of this book, too, is all fucking apologies. It's apologies and apologies. And he writes a sentence. He writes a dedication to the victims' families.
Oh, my God. But all of that is so insulting. He knows what he's doing. He's not freaking apologizing.
He did say that he definitely didn't do a seance to capture the spirit of Bundy.
It reminds me of when we were driving in Canada and the bus said, out of order, sorry. And I'm like, you're a bus. You're not sorry.
You're not a person.
And of course, when Danny was put to death by lethal injection in 2006, he chose to sing his last words. And the last thing anyone ever heard from Danny Rowling was a self-penned 3-minute long hymn praising God.
God, and it must have been feel so good to kill him right after.
Yeah, I can also see God just being like Santa Claus in A Christmas Story. Ho, ho, ho. Just pushing him down the slide to hell. Good lordy. Wow. That is unbelievable. What a crazy story. And that's a little insight into women that love serial killers as well as sort of a cherry on top of this. Sandra London, She seems. What's her story? Is she still around? Is she still trying to bone zone killers?
Yeah, she's still around. Her last book was in 2016. She co-authored a book by one of the women who claims to have been a part of the MK Ultra program. She claims that her father had trained her to be an MK Ultra agent since she was like 6 years old. She's been in an Errol Morris documentary. She's in all kinds of serial killer documentaries. She shows up again and she is a true crime. She is a staple in the true crime world.
She's an interesting woman because, you know, obviously she was exploitive of these monsters to make money off of them. But, you know, so are anybody in the true crime industry. And mm-hmm.
Everyone marries them.
Well, no. But she went the extra length. She went all the way. She also wrote a book on vampirism. Mm-hmm. She's an interesting media figure.
Yeah, she said that she is only doing what no one else has the courage to do.
Suck a serial killer's dick.
What are you talking about? Oh, wow. Again, the people who are courageous in this story are the victims who passed away and fighting for their lives. You know, mm-hmm. what a crazy story that is. Danny Rowling, more. It's after hearing the brutality, I'm almost surprised it's not more mainstream of a tale. But I guess it's almost so gross that...
It's too brutal.
Don't want to talk about it.
It's a very brutal story. It's a brutal story. And then later this year, we'll be covering another heavy hitter series that is like that.
Yeah.
That is one of those where the crimes itself are so shocking that it's weird how there is that. There's the Jeffrey Dahmer obsession, that type of things, because those are shocking crime scenes. But no one, if you watch anything about Jeffrey Dahmer, you don't actually hear all the details of what really happened inside of his house.
You know, the difference is that Danny Rowling's, he's just not that cute. He's not cute like Ted Bundy. And he's not cute like Jeffrey Dahmer. He's just not that cute. He looks like a fucking toad on a log. And that's really the reason why.
He's not media savvy enough.
Wow.
He didn't have the X factor.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, he would be maybe one of the more talented singers, I guess, in the serial killer category, is, again, not once you put in the caveat of serial killer category, the talent's not exactly overflowing.
Yeah, it's not a deep bench, no.
No.
Manson's still better.
Yeah, Manson's great. As a song, I like his songs.
Isolate the audio. Manson's great.
What was that?
Well, thank you all so much for listening.
Yeah, we got you beautiful fucks. We're coming to Denver. They're raising the amount of people that are allowed to be in that theater, the Red Rocks Theater. Come out and watch us. We got a show now. We're
going to
scream at you. We can't wait.
We had such a great time in Grundy County as well. Thanks to everyone who came out to that show. It was just great to see all of you and be with all of you. And we can't wait again for Red Rocks. What a dream come true.
We also, our weed carts are going to be in more stores. We will give that announcement shortly. We're really excited for that. Also, our upcoming partnership with The Last Prisoner Project. Look up there. We are working on a partnership with them now. Honestly, it's an incredible group of people.
They're great.
We're trying to get the last 40,000 people that are in jail for cannabis crimes, trying to get them out. And again, we will physically come and break you out if we have to.
Well, sure. I can bulldoze down some big old walls and get shot a bunch. All right. Last Prisoner Project. Check out everything they're doing. Support them. Able Against Top Bad. Everything political. It's a crazy time. The Matt Gaetz scandal continues to heat up. Oh, also, it's just dumber and dumber and dumber. It's just insane.
He looks like Beavis. Is it Beavis or Butthead? he looks like that guy. Yeah,
it's a comma. Yeah. And then, of course, No Dogs in Space, I don't even know what it means, but it was viral on Spotify, which I think means a boatload of people are listening to it. They're on to Beastie Boys, as Marcus said. And then Dune.
We got one last episode of Dunecast coming out. Well, we got two coming out. I got one Monday and then the one after that. We got two more episodes. Spun, Someplace Underneath, is also... They are now kind of in the middle of doing a Family Annihilator series, which is very interesting. Which, you know, I love.
Ed. Okay, Ed. Are you Ed Humphrey?
But thank you, motherfuckers. It's so good to be back in the mix.
Yeah, thank you all so much. And we can't wait to see you on the road. Hope everyone is healthy, safe, and as happy as you can be. Okay, everyone, hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Again.
Magustalations, which means congratulations for liking us.
Man, I hope the night horse doesn't come on tonight. I can't charge another $60 to my credit card for just sparkly water. I got almost a pound of ice cream the other day, too. Night horse has been busy.
Yeah, I guess so.
Can I name my new hemorrhoids Night Horse?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Did you have old hemorrhoids?
Yeah. No, it's a new affliction.
Oh, I'm sorry, buddy.
That means you're finally a man. That means you're an adult and a business owner.
Hell yeah.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.